way too, till it comes true that you love me inside of you. Where there's music, I wonder how far. Where there's heaven, it's where you are. The darkest night would shine if you would come.
Hi, and welcome to the Edible Community Show and the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro, publisher of Edible Green Mountains. And you know that I share this seat with my publisher, Marla Austin, out of Edible Austin. Marla Camp, out of Edible Austin. Sorry about that, Marla. Every Monday, thanks to our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, we bring you community-based, locally-oriented stories about the farmers, chefs, community members, and food artisans that create the distinct culinary regions we all enjoy throughout the U.S. and Canada. So we have a very exciting show today. We have three interesting and engaging guests. First, I'll be speaking with Anna Thomas. She's the author of Love Soup. And my guess is that anyone who cooked vegetarian food in the 70s is familiar with Anna's first book, The Vegetarian Epicure. It was a phenomenal success. It remains a classic, as do her later books, The Vegetarian Epicure Book 2. And then in 1996, when her cooking style had evolved and she felt that she had something new to say, she wrote The New Vegetarian Epicure, and all of them have been very well received. Well, now she has a new book called Love Soup, and it's a compilation of recipes that she refers to as the food that saved me. And in a few minutes, we're going to hear why. And then we're going to welcome Charlie Shackleton. He and his wife, Miranda Thomas, own Shackleton Thomas, where they make fine handmade furniture and pottery that's been recognized, honored, and collected by both private collectors and museums. Well, Charlie's found an innovative way to connect his work, the community, and nature. He's calling it the Naked Table Project. And if you stay with us, you can learn more about that. And finally, we're going to have everyone's favorite garden expert, Charlie Nardozzi. He'll be with me for the last segment of our show. So let's take a short break, and we'll come back with Anna.
Now the hacienda's dark, the town is sleeping. Now the time has come to part, the time for weeping. Vaya con Dios, my darling. Vaya con Dios, my love. Now the village mission bells are softly ringing. If you listen with your heart, you'll hear them singing. Vaya con Dios, my darling. Vaya con Dios, my love. Wherever you may be, I'll be.
Welcome back to the Edible Community Show on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro. I want to thank our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, for making today's broadcast possible. I am delighted to welcome Anna Thomas, the author of Love Soup, to the show. Many of you will recognize Anna as the author of the Vegetarian Epicure series. She really created an entirely new approach to vegetarian cooking for so many of us, and she's done it again with this new book. It's just full of so many incredible soup recipes and wonderful stories. So I want to say congratulations. Welcome, Anna. And what is the soup of the day today?
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. What an intro. What is the soup of the day? Well, I'll tell you, the soup of the day right here where I am, where we're having a heat wave, and it's still summer, even though it's autumn, was zucchini and basil soup. We just finished having some for lunch, in fact. It was delicious. And that's a soup that's very, very easy to make, and a lot of people I know think of it as the solution to that zucchini problem that they have towards the end of the the end of the summer when neighbors are, you know, creeping up during the night and leaving piles of zucchini on their neighbors' porches, and you know, you just don't know what to do with it all.
And that's a great solution.
It's a beautiful soup.
Well, and I want to get into a little bit of the details of some of your recipes, and maybe this isn't a bad place to start, because many of them use different stocks, And so with this zucchini soup, what did you use? One of your, did you use a roasted stock or?
No, this is a very light, this is a light, clear, fresh flavored sort of soup. And this is a soup that you can make with a very basic light vegetable broth. And you can even use a little bit of diluted canned broth if you're stuck and you want to make it in a hurry. Somebody has left their zucchini on your porch during the night and your basil plants are overflowing and huge. It makes a lot of its own broth. One of the things that I use in soups is I use caramelized onions often in my soups. And I also use roasted vegetables sometimes. I tend to use these kind of preliminary steps sometimes to deepen the flavor of certain ingredients and make them more a more complex sort of flavor, really bring out the best out of certain vegetables. And as a result of that, you get a soup that really sort of makes a lot of its own broth. You start with water and certain things, and by the time you've added those caramelized onions and you've added an entire big bunch of basil, and I'm not kidding, you have already the beginning of a very, very good broth, and then you just need to add a little bit of a vegetable broth of some kind. And in this case, it would be a very light vegetable broth.
Well, and in a way, you know, I had said a couple times in my intros that you talk about soup being the food that saved me, you say, right?
It has saved me many times.
And so on a very, I think, sort of kind of lighthearted way, it may save you when you receive a lot of zucchini, but you also meant it, I think, in some emotional ways. Share with us a little bit about how soup has saved you.
You know, it's been a very important food in my life. I love soup. I always have loved soup. And all my cookbooks have a lot of soup recipes in them. But there have been certain moments, and I actually talk about this in my introduction, there have been certain moments in my life where I really valued soup much more than any other food. One was when I first had my first baby, and a very good friend of mine came over, and people would bring flowers, and they'd bring, you know, lovely baby blankets and things, which was all great, but this friend brought a big pot of minestrone soup and a loaf of bread, and I just nearly wept with joy. I felt like somebody understands me. Somebody knows what I need right now. I felt so comforted by that. And then, of course, all the time I was raising my kids, you know, soup answers so many questions. It's not just delicious, which it is. It is practical. You have a pot of soup, and you have soup. My sister always used to say, soup in the refrigerator is money in the bank. It's like, you know, you are ready. You can just take out that soup and heat it up, and within moments you can have, you know, put together a little meal. But it is a good meal. It's a good meal with something homemade and delicious at the center of it. And so that, you know, the practical aspects of soup became very important. And later, even later, not so long ago, I downsized from a very big house, and I moved to a somewhat smaller place, but it was a real project. I moved to a house that I had to rip down, basically, and rebuild. It was a giant remodel. And so while I was going to be doing the remodel, I moved into the artist's studio next door, and I kind of cleaned it up. I thought, well, this will be an interesting experience, like living in a loft. And I put in this tiny little temporary kitchen. Now, this will be fine for a few months. Now, anybody who's ever done a big remodel knows that those were the words of an insane person. Anybody who hears me say a few months there and they just start laughing out loud, I know they've done a remodel. You know, 3 years later, I was still in that 81-inch kitchen. And this was the period of time when I was in that tiny, tiny little kitchen after having lived in a very big house with a spacious kitchen for many years. I started to really find myself doing a whole different kind of cooking and a whole different kind of entertaining. And I had a 20-inch apartment stove in there with four burners, but really only one big pot could fit on all four of them at once. And I had almost no counter space. All my fancy cooking equipment and all my special stuff was in storage, packed away in boxes. And, you know, I didn't want to stop cooking. I wanted to be able to keep cooking. I wanted to go to the farmer's market and get beautiful fresh produce. I wanted to have people over, have my social life. And I found myself more and more turning to soup. And it was wonderful. At first I thought, oh, this is a hardship and I can't wait to get into my big kitchen. But it really became a sort of a wonderful way of having little dinner parties and just a wonderful way of thinking about food. I really stripped down to the things that mattered, to really the essentials. And I started cooking wonderful soups just every week, all the time. And as I went through the seasons, and they got more and more interesting, because this was something that you could do in a tiny space. You could do it with very little equipment and have a good time. And I'd send out an email, and I'd say, the soup kitchen is open, and my friends would come over, and we'd have a great time. Somebody'd bring a loaf of bread. Somebody might bring something for dessert. You know, I'd open a bottle of wine, and pretty soon we were having a party. It was so easy. It was so comfortable. And I thought, I have to write about this. I have to write a book about soup. And so I did.
Well, and I can say that having read through the book, and I find myself very inspired by it. One thing, you know, you mentioned earlier about sort of sustainability and soup as a way to sustain you. You have a chapter, actually, just about green soups. I think that speaks to another kind of sustenance, and maybe you can share with our listeners a little bit of, because your title is not so much soup as a way of life for your green soup.
I know. I love green soup so much. And when I say green soup, I mean green, the color green, dark, rich, deep green. I first made a green soup recipe a number of years ago, and it was published in the LA Times, and I had such a flood of emails and letters about it. It really struck a chord with people. Apparently, a lot of other people had cooked something along those lines or had a favorite one that they'd made with broccoli instead or something. Anyway, I started to develop more and more of these green soups, but really, there was one year when I had a green soup of some kind in my refrigerator all winter long. I was making one or two of them a week, and I would eat that bowl of green soup, and I swear I felt like I sat up straighter immediately afterwards. I could face the world, you know?
Well, and you said in your book, I think your motivation was originally wanting to sort of feel a little lighter after the holidays.
Yes.
And so you thought this might be a good antidote for all
That's right. Yeah, it was it's a very healthy soup, but it's also delicious and very satisfying. You start with this enormous pile of greens, you know, chard or kale or spinach or a mix of things, mustard greens, whatever, and they cook down into this thick, sort of creamy, beautiful puree, and you cannot believe the amount of greens that is in there, you know, it's fantastic. And there are all sorts of variations, green soup with mushrooms and green soup made with yams and green soup with ginger. And, you know, it's hard to choose sometimes. I love them. I love green soup.
And I find myself curious, as someone who likes to cook and then is just so in love with cookbooks and cookbook authors, what is the process like? So you made that first green soup, you know, with that intention, and then you do write about the different variations. What's going on in your kitchen? Are you actually measuring as you're doing it all?
That's a really good question, because the process of how you cook and the process of how you write for other people to be able to know what you did are very different things. And you really do them in a different way. I mean, in essence, there is a point where the two meet, obviously, and then I'm doing what anybody else is doing when they go in their kitchen and cook and have a good time, but I'm taking notes.
Mm-hmm.
But often, the best cooking, and people who are intuitive cooks and who like to cook and who spend time in the kitchen and know how enjoyable that can be, will immediately know what I'm talking about. The best kind of cooking is when you're not thinking about it too much. And you go into your kitchen and you go to the farmer's market and you see something and you think, oh, that would be good. Oh, look how great these squashes look now that are coming in, these kabochas and these butternuts. Or look at these amazing leeks and these mushrooms that are here. And then you go home and you just start cooking. And you just sort of in a relaxed way start putting things together, and whatever feels right, that's what you do, and you're not thinking about it too much. That's where the best recipes come from, the best dishes. But it's not a recipe at that point. It's just something wonderful that you cooked. And you have to give yourself, in a sense, the freedom to cook that way, and then go back and think, now, wait, what did I do? And then, of course, you have to do it again, and probably several times, and then you're taking notes, you know, and then you're really codifying it and weighing and measuring. But if you stop too much the first time through when you're sort of feeling inspired to do something, and you're writing everything down and measuring everything, it can kind of get in your way.
Well, and that, I think, speaks well to the creative process. And one thing we might want to share with our listeners that I think will also give them some confidence is you're not a trained chef.
No.
I mean, you are a filmmaker. You started cooking when you were in graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you a little bit, because food has clearly been important in your life with your wonderful ethnic background. And maybe you could talk a little more about that creative process and sort of how it came to you. I could use the encouragement, I'll tell you that. A little
all
selfishly,
right.
I love to cook, but I find I get really inhibited.
I so hope that a book like this will help people who feel that way get over some of that. You know, ask yourself this, Deborah, what is the worst thing that can happen? What's
right.
the worst thing that can happen? If you go in your kitchen to make a pot of soup and it doesn't come out quite how you wanted, you know?
Right.
It won't be the end of the world. Just, like, you know, throw it away and call Pizza Man or something. But, you know, next time it will be great. I mean, really, I have to say, but it won't. It won't be terrible. And you won't want to throw it away, because it is a very forgiving thing, soup. It's got a lot of latitude. There's a lot of flexibility there. I always tell people, this is the pass-fail class that you really can't fail. You know, it's very easy. Anybody can do this. And it's true that I've now had a lot of experience cooking. I've cooked for many years. But I am a home cook. I'm not a professional chef. I've never had a restaurant. I've never had a catering company. I'm a home cook. And it is just a pleasure for me. I love doing it. It is a relaxation. It is a way to get away from the stressful aspects of the work that I do in film, which I love, but there are definitely stressful aspects to it. And going into the kitchen and indulging in a creative act that can have its entire arc in the course of one day. You know, you get up in the morning, you have an idea about something, or you're at the market, at the farmer's market, and you think, oh, this would be nice. And you go home and you start cooking and you call a couple of friends, and pretty soon you're having dinner and everybody's enjoying it and you have a wonderful time, and then you're done. And the whole thing has happened in the space of one day instead of 3 years like it does with film. So it's a beautiful experience, and you do not have to be professional. Home cooking is the thing that I really hope will be in resurgence, you know, because I think that it has fallen off. Well, I know it has. I mean, there are fewer people doing home cooking regularly now than there were before, and I worry about this. I have to say, this is one of the things. This keeps me up at night. I worry about it, and I really feel that we lose something so important when we lose home cooking. And it's not just part of our culture and our history in our own families and in our own, you know, ethnic sort of circle. It's also a question, there's a kind of a bigger question here. Do we really want to give away our relationship with food solely to commercial interests? I mean, is that something we want? I don't think so.
I would think our listeners would say absolutely not.
I think we don't. I think we want to keep a closer relationship somewhere, somehow, with what we eat and know about it and be involved in it, and it's not difficult. And that's why that's another very compelling reason why I wanted to write about soup, because to me it's like the entryway into home cooking. It is really so easy and comfortable, and you really can do it in any sized kitchen, as I know, because I wrote this whole book in that tiny kitchen. And I think that I want to say, especially to young people who maybe haven't been around home cooking that much, visit the land of your ancestors. The kitchen, just turn around and go in there and cook something. You'll be happy. You'll feel better, you know?
Well, and I thought you might have, you know, the other way we could take that last comment is visit the land of your ancestors from the perspective of a cultural heritage. Yours
is
Polish, correct?
Absolutely.
And tell us a little how that informed what you're doing. I know you talk about putting potatoes in some of your recipes, and
well,
you know,
I always
you've
say,
evolved a lot from there.
Whenever I, I've done a few cooking demonstrations in the course of promoting this book, and you know, from time to time, I'll do something like that. And I always find myself starting by caramelizing onions for something, because that's such a big part of the flavor palette that I use in my cooking. And I tell this story. I say, you know, the story about the Polish cook. The Polish cook goes into the kitchen, cuts up an onion or two, throws it in the pan, starts sautéing it, and then says, okay, let's see, what shall I cook? I mean, it's just this automatic, you know. But actually, I grew up with a very different kind of food around me, because coming from a Polish immigrant household, that is not really a fresh market-based kind of cuisine. It's a very meat-oriented kind of kitchen. And I think that the important thing for me was not so much what kind of food was being cooked in the house, but that I lived in a house where there was home cooking going on all the time. It was just, that was the normal rhythm of life. And when you're around that, you absorb that. You absorb the idea that this is regular. This is normal. This is what people do. You don't have to be special to do this. You go out, you buy some whatever, some ingredients, you bring them into your kitchen, you do a few things to them, and then it's a meal, it's dinner. And when you live with that, and you're around people who do cook, you take that in, and even if you start to cook very different kinds of food later, as I did when I went to college and I started to really learn to cook myself, I was cooking a very, very different kind of cuisine. But what I had internalized from my mother and all the relatives and everybody was home cooking. It was normal. It was what you could do. Anybody could do this. And that's a very valuable thing to have. And I really want to encourage people who feel intimidated, let go of that. There's nothing scary about it. It really is fine in the kitchen. It's just fine in there.
Well, and I wanted to ask you, also, I don't know that I've read anywhere what encouraged you to become a vegetarian. Was there
a very
seminal moment? Or?
You know, a lot of people make a very, very conscious decision on a certain day. They say, I'm going to be a vegetarian. Or now, as with my younger son, Teddy, I'm going to be a vegan starting today. I never did that. That didn't happen that way for me. It was very curious, but I just found myself eating less and less meat, and then one day I realized, I guess I'm not eating meat anymore. And it had just sort of come upon me in this gradual way. So for me, it was very easy, and I didn't come to it from an ideological point of view. Now, I don't disagree with the reasons. There's a lot of people who decide consciously for ethical or for health reasons or for philosophical reasons to be vegetarian or to be vegan. I support them. I think those reasons are all good. But I came to all of my cooking from a somewhat more hedonistic place. I mean, I agree with all those ideas, but when I sit down to eat, I do not want to eat ideology. I want to eat delicious food on my plate. And that's really how I came to develop my style of cooking, because I found that I really didn't want to eat meat anymore. And I needed to figure out a way to eat well. And that's when I started to really develop my own style of cooking.
And what would you say characterizes your style from your perspective?
I think it's very much honoring the ingredients, starting with very best ingredients that I can find. This is something I've stressed in all of my food writing. And also, really, I think... I love food that has some history to it. So I do use all the influences and all. I mean, there's a soup in this book called pickle soup, which is really
yes.
A very hearty barley and mushroom and vegetable soup that does have that secret ingredient of finely chopped pickles in it. But it is something that's a very traditional kind of soup that I would have had as a child from my mother's Polish kitchen. But I'm also influenced by a lot of the traditions of the places where I've spent a lot of time, like Mexico and like the Mediterranean countries. And I love to explore those things. But I like to make food that is fresh, that's made with very the very best ingredients, the most seasonal ingredients, and that really is itself. I don't like food that's like trying to be an analog of something else. I never was that interested in, for example, that style of vegetarian cooking that was around, you know, in that period in the 70s. When I was in college and I was starting to work on my first book, which was the fake meat school,
right,
of vegetarian cooking. I don't know exactly what to call it, but you know, where you make like the thing that's like a cutlet or the thing that's like a, I don't know, like a meatloaf or something, and you try to make it be like a piece of meat, but it's not made of meat. I wasn't interested in that. I wanted it to be what it was and to just be a really good version of itself.
Well, and you've definitely succeeded. I think, I guess one word I would use, I always think there's a bit of an exotic quality, and I think it's because you use so many interesting international flavor profiles in a lot of your dishes.
I'm interested in flavor. I you know, and if I find something good, it's mine. I use it.
Yeah, well, it's a wonderful book, Anna, and I wish you so much luck and success.
Thank
and we only
you.
Have about a minute left, but I was going to ask you, what are some of your favorite fall soups now that the leaves are turning? And
oh, I have a whole chapter on squash soups and soups made from winter squash, and I have to say, when fall comes around, I love those squash soups. And I like to make the winter squash soups using some other ingredients to sort of deepen the flavor and give a little more complexity. I think a lot of people make butternut squash soup and it's just a little too simple tasting for me. So I combine winter squashes with things like roasted celery root, or I combine them with pears and ginger, or I combine squash with, for example, tomatillos and a little bit of chili for a soup that's got a really very bright, piquant sort of flavor. And I've got a whole series of winter squash soups here, and I'm looking forward to those as soon as the heat wave breaks.
Well, we're enjoying a little bit of a heat wave where I live. I live in Vermont, but I know these squash soups are going to be on a lot of tables very soon. And thank you again for joining us. The book is Love Soup by Anna Thomas. It's available everywhere you can buy great books, and it's a wonderful book, and I highly recommend it for all sorts of reasons.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anna.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
I was dancing with my darling to the Tennessee waltz when an old friend I happened to see. I introduced her to my loved one, and while they were dancing, my friend stole my sweetheart from me. I remember the night and the Tennessee waltz. Now I know just how much I have lost. Yes, I lost my little darling the night they were playing the beautiful Tennessee. Thank you. was dancing with my darling to the Tennessee waltz when an old friend I happened to see. I introduced her to my loved one, and while they were dancing, my friend stole my sweetheart.
Welcome back to the Edible Community Show. I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro, and I want to thank our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, for making this program possible. Well, we've all heard about knowing where our food is from. And Charlie Shackleton, an accomplished artisan furniture maker, and his wife Miranda Thomas, an accomplished artisan potter, believe that philosophy should also apply to where you sit to enjoy that meal, as well as the vessel that you consume it from. They were motivated by the desire to connect their customers and the community to the source of their work, and they designed the Naked Table Project, a provocative name for a very effective event that debuted in August and now is going to happen again this weekend and in October. And also on the calendar next week is the 6th annual Fine Furniture and Woodworking Festival at the Union Arena in Woodstock, and then a communal meal that's going to celebrate the Naked Table Project. So there's a lot coming up this weekend, and we're going to hear all about it from Charlie Shackleton. Welcome, Charlie.
Hi there.
How are you today?
I'm very well, thanks. Enjoying the sunshine.
Good. Oh, I know. It's just beautiful. So, Charlie, I think my first question to you would be, what are the benefits of knowing where our table is from? We know what some folks think about knowing where our food is from, but why is it important to know where our table is from?
Well, I think part of it comes from me always having had a fascination with, I'm a maker as opposed to an intellectual, and I've always really enjoyed making things, and so that led me to making furniture. And I think what I've slowly realized over the many years, 22 years of being in business making furniture, that I'm not only, and I guess this just dawned on me this year, which is kind of slow, but that we are really mostly interested in using our products as a way to connect with people. They are like icons, or you could say fetishes, although that doesn't always have the best connotation. But they are things that they symbolize something. And it's one thing having a beautiful dining room table to show off to your friends, but it's another whole thing if that dining room table is not only something you eat off and gather around and show off to your friends, but it also represents something you believe in. And that is very often to do with connecting people to each other, but also connecting people to the environment around them and the importance of that. And so it's sort of, I don't know whether this answers your question or not.
Oh, I think it does.
But it's to do with that connection. And a table represents so much. If you think of your kitchen table or your family table in the home, it's not only where you eat around and gather and communicate. It's also where you do a lot of things, whether it be homework or making bread or making models or whatever you do. But it's also a summation of the history of what you've been through and that connection. So this project, what is exciting about this project is, as everyone in business knows, you spend most of your life scratching your head how to reach out and connect with people. And this was a project which I really searched with inside myself to find out, what am I really interested in? What is really driving me? And I thought a lot of it was to do with economics and people, what they're feeling right now. But it's also led, that feeling within people has led people to think about getting closer to the soil and the environment and making their own things which are usable and functional and not being quite so materialistic. And so it really touched a core. And when we invited people into the workshop to make their own, local people who very often couldn't afford regular furniture, but to come in and make their own furniture and then bring them back out into the forest and see where that wood came from, it was quite honestly, I have to say, it was almost like a spiritual experience, seeing the connection that those people made with the table and the forest and each other doing it. And it was just such a gift to me, never mind to those people who did it.
Well, and maybe we should take a step back, because we haven't really defined the project for our listeners yet. So why don't you share with us certainly your inspiration, and now let's define a little bit for them what the Naked Table Project is all about.
Well, on the very simplest level, and it's quite a complicated project, but on the very simplest level, we invited people into our work, and we're well known locally, but I think we're mostly known for selling fancy, high-end, beautiful furniture all over the world. And there's a lot of local people who are very admiring of what we do, but they felt they could never afford one of our tables. And so we invited, based on the philosophy that I talked about just now, we invited 15 people into our workshop on a Saturday, starting at 9:30, make a table, spend the day making it, and mostly assembly, because the machining part we had done prior to that. Now, just to back up a little bit, when we first decided to do the project, I went out, I found a local forester who sustainably managed a lot of local forest lots around here, a guy called Pat Bartlett, and I went out and met him, met the logger, met the sawyer, met the trucking guy, and all these people, we photographed all the way along the line each of these individuals who had their own life story. We also photographed seedling maple trees. And then we followed the truck to White River Junction, where Richard Wright has a sawmill, and he also has a kiln. He saw the maple logs, he then dried the logs, and then they went, and Richard Wright is, we took a wonderful photo in front of the kiln with his father, his son, and his uncle on the family farm, which they've owned for many generations. And then it went from there to another wonderful guy called Dave Dugdale in Heartland. And he owns a beef farm of about 180, 200 acres. But in the middle of this farm, he has a fairly new building, which houses a CNC machine, which is a computer numerically controlled, basically a thing that machines out the wood. And we would machine it out ourselves, but our machines aren't so efficient or accurate. So we machined all the parts, the legs, the skirts, the tops, and he did all that on his farm. And then he brought those parts to the workshop, where we then did all the handwork and assembly and put the table together and put the finish on. And what's really exciting on Saturday is that we've combined with a company called Vermont Natural Coatings, and they are as natural a finish as you can find in this day and age. It's a water-based acrylic finish, but it's 10% whey from cow's milk, which has incredible bonding properties. And they are collaborating with us, which is something I believe in hugely, to put the finish on. At the end of the day, everyone goes home, and the next day we put all the tables end-to-end, which is an 80-foot-long table, and then we have a lunch, which is cooked by the Barnard General Store, made entirely from local food, meat and vegetables and cider and all that sort of thing. And it's really to symbolize and celebrate, the making of the tables, but also the source of the tables, and all those people who are involved in the chain of custody, is what I call it, you know, the logger, the forester, the sawyer, the miller, and the furniture makers, and then the table makers, and then the people who are going to eat around it, that they're all there at the same table celebrating it. And it's a symbolic event as much as anything else, but it does, it's extremely picturesque, I might say.
Well, and it's amazing to me how it's all truly from within the place. I mean, we're talking about Vermont in this instance, so we have listeners from all over, but you've managed to go with what, perhaps within 100 miles of where you're located?
Oh, 20 miles.
20 miles.
And oh, and they're all such wonderful people. That's what's so exciting about it. And they all have such wonderful, and it's, so it's like a cycle. And I think people love, the people that I've connected with about this in the table, what they love most about it is it's not just making a table, bringing it home and using it. It's all the connections, and it's like circles within circles and overlapping circles, people connecting to each other and connecting to the environment. And it's, there's a message there, and people love that kaleidoscopic feel that the project has.
Well, and I was going to ask, because you've had one successful weekend, you have another one coming up this weekend and then one in October, what were some of the benefits? And you've sort of shared that already. I don't know what you're thinking of in terms of longer-term benefits. What are some of your thoughts of other than the great stories that will get developed around all of these tables?
Well, there's a wonderful photographer who has followed me. My ancestor went to the Antarctic about 100 years ago, and the one bright thing he did was he took an amazing photographer. And people are always saying, oh, you're like the explorer doing this and doing that. And the only thing that I've ever done similar to him was that I took a fantastic photographer with me, a guy called John. John Gilbert Fox, who lives in Hanover. And he does all the work for Billings Farm and a number of notable institutions around here. But he photographed everything. And so what I really want to do is put it together into a book. And more of a book that's really readable pictorially. Not only the seedling all the way through to the table in the family home, but also on the left-hand side of the page, a picture of each of the people in the chain of custody and a little piece about their story. People are always coming into our store and saying, oh, my God, you got a wonderful story, a furniture maker, and your grandfather did this, blah, blah, blah. And I always turn to them and say, you also have a wonderful story. And, you know, stories are full of all kinds of different emotions and stuff, but everyone has a story. And what I love about all these people in the chain of custody is they all have incredible stories, and they're so interesting. And I want to put it into a book called The Naked Table Project, or The Naked Table, or something like that. But we also want to then go out to other communities and show them how it's really more of an icon, how, like, there's another project going, which is a weaving project, which they're making rugs and things like that out of used textiles, which is also going on in Woodstock as another sustainable project. But these are all examples of things that can be done. And it's not just the products, which can then be labeled as ecologically friendly. It's to do with how these projects bring people together who very often would never have been brought together in another way. Perhaps they'd meet in the store. If you see what I'm saying.
I see exactly what you're saying. Well, and then I also think the fact that you're planting seedlings and how you're doing the GPS coordinates.
Ah, right.
Pretty incredible.
Well, that was really fun, yeah. And we're going to do that this weekend. We're going out to the forest and identifying 15 trees, and we'll take a photograph of the person with the tree that is replacing their tree, which will be managed by Pat Bartlett. And then on the bottom of the table, there'll be a certificate stating the GPS coordinates and with a photograph of the person with the tree and a certificate saying where they made the table. But we want to, I'm very excited in designing a whole line of naked furniture, if you could like to call it like that. We now have a naked oval, and we're going to advertise to these customers further afield so that they can come for the weekend, stay in a local hotel, and experience a similar sort of thing. Probably won't be quite as good a price, but this one we priced at $650, and that covers, that pays all those people in the chain of custody and pays for the meal and a T-shirt and all that sort of thing. And if there's any extra, it's pretty small, but it goes towards Sustainable Woodstock and their efforts to promote sustainability.
Well, it's a very elaborate way to support a cause you care about, but such an impressive.
I thought it was very simple when I started out, and now my brain is just about to blow out the sides.
Aware of a simple idea. Well, the other thing we wanted to speak about is what's going on this weekend, not only your communal event, but then you also have the Fine Woodworking Festival, and that's a little bit of the other side of you, right? I mean, not so much the other side of you internally, because you write about how you really feel that the artisans who are producing the furniture that you create in your workshop, they have a piece of their soul in there almost. I mean, so this naked table thing really isn't that distant, except for perhaps the outcome, right? The type of
product. I think the connection with the Naked Table Project and the people who are showing at the Fine Furniture Festival, we've been making furniture for 22 years, Fine Furniture, and it's not until this project came along and we advertised it and showed it to people that they suddenly understood what we were doing. We've been doing this for 22 years, but we came up with this little picture storybook project. And suddenly people's eyes were open wide, and everybody else in that festival is is doing exactly what we've been doing for the last 22 years in terms of their philosophy. And you meet all these people, they have this, they have the same passion or more about what they do. And it's all to do with connecting with other people and connecting with the environment, connecting with beautiful wood, and using their hands to express themselves. And it's really exciting. And to, you know, the Naked Table Project is going on at the back, and that'll be great fun to see. But what it's really showing off is all the amazing fine work that you can find. I mean, I don't know, there must be nearly 50 or more exhibits at the show of people doing what they love to do, and that is expressed through their work.
Do you know how people can find out more about it? Is there a particular website?
You're lucky. www.vermontwoodfestival.org. And if you go to that site, it says www.vermontwoodfestival.org. And it's on Saturday and Sunday, September 26th and 27th, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. And there's great food there. There's lots of fun. There's live music. You can buy stuff. And the admission is $7 per person. And it's a well worth event, and it's an absolute classic fall event. I think it was named one of Vermont's top fall events a year or two ago.
Well, terrific! And then you can see folks making their naked table at the same time.
Exactly,
right?
They'll be fully clothed. I have to hasten to add, so please don't hesitate to come, based on the fact that you don't
right.
want to see people with no clothes on.
Exactly,
and the naked lunch is also a fully clothed event.
At least for this year.
A lot of people ask me and say, well, why did you call it the Naked Table event? They
Perfect
say that's a
question.
Very catchy name. And I have to say, it's to do with really, it comes back to me during last winter trying to figure out why we were doing what we were doing. And basically bearing our soul, if you will, about what is the essence of what is the bare bones of why we are all doing this. And that's why it's called the Naked Table. And it's a very plain, simple table, but it feels like it was made by somebody, and it's fresh from the woods, naked, if you will.
Perfect. Well, I want to thank you, Charlie, so much for spending time with us. And I know that these tables are going to have all sorts of histories and stories that come with them. And I look forward to your book, and I hope that you'll let me know when that's going to come out.
I hope you'll come to the festival.
I would love to.
And I'm also a big admirer of what you do and the magazine you produce.
Thank you.
I think it's wonderful. So congratulations
to
you.
Thanks very much. So take care.
Take care of you as well, Deborah.
Bye-bye.
When you treat me this way, I know I love you, but what can I do? I'm a fool to care. I'm a fool to cry. When you tell me goodbye, you left me so blue when you were untrue. I'm a fool to care. I know I should laugh and call it a day.
Hi, welcome back to the Edible Community Show. I want to thank Hearst Ranch, our sponsor of this week's show, for making our program possible. So now it's the segment everyone loves. We're back with everyone's favorite gardening expert, Charlie Nardozzi. And those of you who've listened to my show before know that there's no one better to talk to about gardening and what's going on in the garden and outside. Charlie knows all about our Love Soup interview with Anna Thomas, so we're going to talk to him a little bit about what kind of soup should we be making now. But let me say welcome. Welcome, Charlie.
Well, it's great to be back, Deborah.
And let's start with that. We had a great conversation with Anna Thomas,
mm-hmm.
who was telling us all about her green soup, which sort of has kale and spinach and those things as the basis, and then telling us a little bit about squash soup. So are these things we can find in our garden now?
Oh, absolutely. Any of the cool season vegetables or the things that take a long time to harvest, like the winter squashes, for example. They're coming into their prime now, the butternuts, the acorns, the buttercup squashes. One of my favorite soups, and one that actually I won't start eating quite yet, I'll wait another month or two, would be the potato leek soup. Because the leeks have been growing very slowly through the garden. They're one of those what I call plant and forget it kind of crops. You plant them in the spring and you just kind of forget about them, and you don't really notice them until like August, and it's like, whoa, look at that. They're big. They're pretty big leeks over there. And then they get sweeter as they go into the season, and there's some varieties that are very attractive, one called Blue Soleil has blue-green foliage on it. And there's some other varieties that are more winter hardy. So they'll actually get frozen. I've gone out in the winter in December, picked frozen leeks, brought them in, and made leek soup out of them. So that's one of the soups that you can look forward to. But as far as right now, if you have carrots, a carrot ginger soup is always a nice warming soup on a cold fall night. Mm-hmm. That would work really well. Any of the root crops, for that matter. You can still be making borscht on a nice summer kind of fall, summer day, you know, it's still warm out there. You can do a little borscht. I just made a zucchini soup not too long ago because I still have a plethora of zucchini piling in, and I've run out of ideas on what to do with them.
Well, it's really funny you mentioned zucchini soup because I asked Anna Thomas, what is the soup of the day? And It was a zucchini basil soup.
Perfect.
So great minds are thinking alike here with all of that. What else is going on in the garden? You know, things are sort of, there's some leggy stuff out there.
Yeah.
What should people be doing right
now? It's a glorious time in the garden, actually. Up in Vermont, of course, we're much further north, so it's colder and we have a limited number of things to do. But as you go south and west, you could be planting a whole host of things in the garden. And even in Vermont, for that
you
matter.
You could be planting?
Planting,
in the garden?
Yes. I'm always a big advocate of planting. You continue to plant right through the summer and into the fall. Quick season greens like arugulas or any of the mesclun mixes, spinach, Swiss chard, kale, mustard greens, any of the things that you'll be harvesting within 20, 30 days, you could be planting now. Even in Vermont, you could be planting these. And they'll come up pretty quickly because the soils are really warm, but they'll really thrive under those cool temperatures that we have this time of year and with a little bit of dew on them. And they'll stay more on the sweet side. I mean, everyone's probably had the arugula that's gone by a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
A little bite to that flavor when you start munching into it. But when they mature in the fall, you don't have that kind of flavor. It stays much more on the mild side.
Now, when you replant, what do you want to do to your soil for that?
Well, the first thing you should be doing, this is kind of all happening at once, is ripping out things that are done. If you've had bush beans and you've been hanging on to your bush beans all summer long, hoping that there might be a second or a third crop, and you get a bean here, a bean there, be merciless. Rip them out. Pull them all out. And if you free up a bed or two, pull out your tomatoes that were blighted. I just did that myself. Mm-hmm. Or maybe your peppers that are kind of done for the season. There's really not much coming along. And what you can do is create a new raised bed there, raising up the soil 6 to 8 inches high, mix in a nice layer of compost, maybe a quarter, half-inch layer, till that into the soil or turn it into the soil, rake it nice and smooth, and you're ready to go. And you could be seeding crops in there, the greens I mentioned you can do. You can even do some quick root crops, a radish crop, a quick crop of some of the little baby beets would be really nice this time of year. Pop them into the soil, water them well, and then you might want to protect them, especially if you're further south, you might still have a lot of insect pressure. So you can put a floating row cover over them, or just keep an eye on them as they germinate and make sure the slugs don't go in there or flea beetles don't start eating their leaves, and protect them in those first early weeks so that they can get established. But then once established, they'll just keep growing right through September, October, depending on where you are, into November.
And what about the cool nights? You know, some of our northern, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, we've had some 30s.
We have, yeah.
So are you covering things up at night? Or?
Yes. The product I mentioned, the floating row cover, is a great thing for that. What it is a white cheesecloth-like material that lets air, water, and light in, but it keeps plants warmer. It can keep plants from freezing down to about 25, 26 degrees. So you just lay it right over your crops. You just lay it over the crop of greens, the melons that you're trying to ripen, which is what we're doing at my house right now. We've got a whole bunch of Charentaises and cantaloupes and honeydew melons, and they're just kind of on the edge of ripening. They're almost there, Deborah. We can smell it.
And if you picked them, they wouldn't ripen inside?
Well, they'd ripen a little bit. They wouldn't taste as good. So we're trying to push them as far as we can. So we put a floating row cover over that whole melon patch to try to keep them a little bit warmer, because a lot of times that's really what's going to ripen a tomato that's not completely red, or a melon. It's not so much the sunlight, it's the warmth. They need those warm temperatures to ripen themselves.
And what about for our listeners who don't have a big yard or a garden plot, or who want something a little simpler, what can you do with pots? Is this time of year a pot time of year? Can you, you know, the way you're talking about prepping a soil in a large pot, would it work the same as it would in the ground or not quite?
Yeah, pots would work just as well as in the ground. If you have a tomato that's kind of done, you can pull that out, plant the greens that I mentioned or some of the root crops that I mentioned. If you have a few favorite plants that are still producing well, a great hot pepper, for example, or a beautiful eggplant, pots are great because you can move them around. You can, first of all, move them, if it's going to be a cool night, into a protected spot indoors or in a garage, closer to the house sometimes is all it needs. And also, this time of year, the sun angles have changed, if you haven't noticed.
Right.
The days are shorter, the angle of the sun is much lower in the sky. So what was full sun in July may not be full sun any longer in September. So with a container or a pot, you can follow the sun around. You can get a little anal about this and go out there at 10 o'clock and move it, 12 o'clock and move it, 2 o'clock. But probably just once a day or once a few days, you can move it to a sunnier spot in your back deck or patio. That way you can maximize the amount of suns on there and you can get even more crops.
Great. Well, now, another thing we have a lot of right now are apples, and some folks have these fruit trees at home and might want to know a little bit about what's going on. I just was at a friend's house. We had apples from their tree. It was very exciting knowing that there was nothing used on them to grow them. And so tell us a little about what people can be looking for.
Well, if they have an apple, one of the favorite things I did, and I just did this with my family, is we go gleaning. Now, gleaning is you go around and you find a lot of wild trees or wild plants. Now, you, of course, you have to make sure it's not on someone's yard.
You're not trespassing on someone's property.
Excuse me, can I pick all your fruit off your tree? Usually these are wild trees. They're on public lands and no one's taking care of them. No one's watching them. But there are some pear trees, for example, that we found that's on wild land. And these pear trees are growing really well and they have beautiful pears on them. Now, they have, beautiful is a relative term. They have blemishes on them. They're not completely perfect pear shape, but the flavor is there. And if you're just going to use them, like I use them for shakes, for example, or if you use them for pies or for cooking, they're great for that, or just snacking on them. They're really good for that. So one of the things you can do is to kind of look around where you are, look at the wild areas. You might find some wild grapes, wild apples, wild pears, things that are out there that you can just harvest for free. Just, of course, make sure it's not on someone's private property.
And the grapes and the, you know, I'm always concerned about grapey berry things and poisonous or So is there any hint you can give people, like if it looks this way, it's all right?
Well, most people, I think, can recognize a grape leaf. And that's going to be that's going to be the thing that kind of tips you off that this is actually a grape plant, a grape vine growing, and not some other kind of plant that might be poisonous. But obviously you want to double check it, check out the leaf, check out the fruit. Find somebody who knows these kinds of things or check out online for some photos to identify it to make sure you're not eating something that could potentially be poisonous.
Which leads us to the mushroom topic.
Yes, it does. We're
speaking
just going all over the place.
We are going all over. But you're talking about gleaning.
Yes,
so
I
think of wild crafting, which I think gleaning is distinguished because you don't think of a pear or an apple tree as something wild in the same way.
Right, and actually, gleaning is really, it's used here locally in Vermont by food banks and food shelves. They go out into farms and the farmers say, you know, we're done with this field for the season. You can come in and have whatever's left. And that's a way to harvest the produce, bring it back to the food shelf, and then feed people who need it. So that's kind of where the gleaning thing comes in. And then we go into wildcrafting, which is really more just kind of foraging, going out into the wild. And mushrooms, certainly this time of year, you'll be able to find some of the fall oyster mushrooms, for example. It's been kind of dry in Vermont the last few weeks or so, so you're not going to get much mushrooms coming up. But depending on where you are, you can definitely get some mushrooms. And there are local mushroom walks that happen. And that's probably the best way to educate yourself is to go out with an expert. They'll show you the mushrooms, show you how to identify them, so that when you go into the wild, you get the right one.
Which will be very important because we want our listeners to come back.
I do.
So we need
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
So in the few minutes that we have left, what do you want to tell folks for the next 3 weeks or so that they should be thinking about? They're going to plant?
Yes, they're going to plant.
And they're going to plant some new things. How long do we have left in our season?
Well, it depends on where you are. Up here in Vermont, you know, we'll have maybe 6 weeks or so. by the lake down here in Lake Champlain, this area, you know, we'll probably get a late frost maybe in mid to end of October. Mm-hmm. If you're in the mountains, it's going to be sooner. Some people might have already gotten a frost. As you go further south and further west, the days are going to give you a little more leniency so that you can go into November without getting a frost. But a frost isn't necessarily the end. A lot of the crops I mentioned, the kales, the broccolis, the wheat, they will last. They will go through a frost or two, and a lot of times you'll get an early frost, and then you'll have two or three weeks of just beautiful weather afterwards. It's traditionally called Indian summer.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can get through that one little bump in the road, you can keep your garden going longer and longer into the season.
And I guess there's some folks who say that flavor actually improves for some of these
vegetables. Exactly, yes, exactly. It does improve, especially for root crops. Parsnips, for example, is one of my favorites. I don't even harvest them in the fall. I bury them in hay mulch come November, December when it starts freezing. Hmm. And then in the spring when it thaws out a little bit, that's when I harvest the parsnips. Because by then, all those carbohydrates have turned to sugars and they're really sweet. And you can just kind of, they're almost like glazed when you cook them. So they're really a whole different vegetable than if you ate it right now.
And that's one of the benefits that you have, is that you can be patient. You know, lots of new gardeners want to go and get it. But maybe our listeners will know that they can leave some in the ground so that they can try those later. And well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today,
it's
Charlie.
Always a pleasure to be here, Deb.
It's always fun to hear what you have to say and add some excitement to the broadcast. And thank all of you for listening. This has been the Edible Community Show on the Heritage Radio Network.